This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June 1993 examination in English as a Second Language. Paper 4, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, candidate number, and center number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. Now you're all ready. Here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. You will hear each question twice. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part one. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each question twice. Question 1. You ask a passerby for directions to the Maritime Museum. How do you get there?
The Maritime Museum? Yes. You turn left at the end of this street, then you take the 2nd on the right. You can't miss it. The Maritime Museum. Yes, you turn left at the end of this street, then you take the 2nd on the right. You can't miss it.
Question 2. You are listening to the radio when you hear the following advertisement. What is the phone number of the taxi firm?
Need a taxi? All our cars are modern and air-conditioned, and our drivers know every street.
You're in a cafe and ask what food is available. What can you have to eat?
I'm afraid we stopped serving hot meals half an hour ago. There's fresh fruit but no salads. I suppose I could make you a sandwich. Would that be okay? I'm afraid we stopped serving hot meals half an hour ago. There's fresh fruit, but no salads. I suppose I could make you a sandwich. Would that be okay?
Question 4. You hear the following announcement over the college public address system. Where will Mr. Baku's lesson take place?
Would all students in Mr. Baco's literature group go to room D39 today, as C40 is being used for an exam? Would all students in Mr. Baco's literature group go to room D39 today, as C40 is being used for an exam.
Question 5. You have arrived at a large factory where you have an interview for a job. Who are you told to report to?
Ah, yes, job interviews. Go straight down the corridor to room 12 and ask for Mr. West. He's Dr. Hassan's secretary. He'll show you where to wait. Ah, yes, job interviews. Go straight down the corridor to room 12 and ask for Mr. West. He's Dr. Hassan's secretary. He'll show you where to wait.
Question 6. You're listening to the radio. What sort of program starts at 7 o'clock? Why might the program interest young people?
At 6 o'clock you can hear a repeat of the Saturday play, and that's followed by the news at 6:45. And at 7 o'clock, Dr. Judith Rose chairs a discussion on lowering the minimum age limit for drivers. At 6 o'clock you can hear a repeat of the Saturday play, and that's followed by the news at 6:45. And at 7 o'clock, Dr. Judith Rose chairs a discussion on lowering the minimum age limit for drivers.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at part two, exercise one. Part 2. Exercise 1. Questions 7 to 12. Listen to this radio announcement and complete the notes. You will hear the announcement twice.
And at lunchtime today, the popular magazine program Shop Around. And this week, there are features for everyone. First, there's a detailed look at the music equipment available on the high street and at out-of-town discount stores. For rock fans confused by the range of listening gear available these days, or anyone beginning to think seriously about sound quality, there's a note on the best buys in the area this week. As for leisure, they'll be looking at a family excursion that really will have something for everyone. It's the new Adventure World, which has just opened. As well as a massive fun fair, there is a local crafts display with work on sale and an art gallery presently housing a traveling exhibition of work by American artists of the 50s and 60s. You can also visit the zoo, where there is a world-renowned breeding program, and see what is being done to protect endangered species from Europe and North Africa. Lastly, there's a feature linked to a local department store which is holding a sale of winter sports clothes. There's information about materials and suggestions about how to choose a style that'll still be in fashion next season as well as this. Those are just a few of the reasons why you should tune in to Shop Around this week. So don't forget to join us at 12:30 today.
Now you will hear the announcement again.
And at lunchtime today, the popular magazine program Shop Around. And this week, there are features for everyone. First, there's a detailed look at the music equipment available on the high street and at out-of-town discount stores. For rock fans confused by the range of listening gear available these days, or anyone beginning to think seriously about sound quality, there's a note on the best buys in the area this week. As for leisure, they'll be looking at a family excursion that really will have something for everyone. It's the new Adventure World, which has just opened. As well as a massive funfair, there is a local crafts display with work on sale and an art gallery presently housing a traveling exhibition of work by American artists of the 50s and 60s. You can also visit the zoo, where there is a world-renowned breeding program, and see what is being done to protect endangered species from Europe and North Africa. Lastly, there's a feature linked to a local department store which is holding a sale of winter sports clothes. There's information about materials and suggestions about how to choose a style that'll still be in fashion next season as well as this. Those are just a few of the reasons why you should tune in to Shop Around this week. So don't forget to join us at 12:30 today. That is the end of Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now, look at the questions for Exercise 2. Exercise 2. Questions 13 to 18. Listen to this language teacher describing the arrangements for a forthcoming exchange visit to Lille and complete the notes. You will hear the information twice.
As you all know, the town of Morlaix is twinned with Lille in France, and cultural exchanges have been going on between our two towns for some time. However, this is the first year that educational visits have been organized. I'm sure you realize what an important step this is for our respective language programs, and we hope that this joint venture will be a success. I have in front of me details of travel arrangements and a program of the main activities and events which will be taking place during the course of your week in France. I'm sure I don't have to remind you that you have to bring your travel documents, your passports, and your name tags to help your host families meet up with you at the station. In the event of an emergency while you're in France, you should contact the exchange coordinator, Mr. Roland, that's R-O-L-A-N-D. His number is Lille 970-3983. Now, you all have the train and ferry times, both here and in France, printed on your tickets, so I don't need to remind you of these. I'll just go through the main meeting arrangements briefly, so that if there are any questions, we can deal with them now. Everyone should assemble outside the Lost Property Office at Leeds Central Station at least half an hour before the train leaves for London. You're catching the 10 a.m. on Friday, November the 9th. Report to Mr. Owen, who will be accompanying you as far as Paris, and we'll deal with any problems on the journey. He'll also do his best to see that you all make the connection in Paris for Lille. So, stick together as a group. Don't wander off looking for drinks or toilets without letting him know, or you might find you've been left behind.
On arrival in Lille, make sure you're wearing your name tags and go to the meeting point under the large clock opposite Platform 2, where your host families will be waiting for you, along with the French exchange coordinator, who will help with the introductions. You'll have the weekend getting to know your host families, and from Monday, you'll be expected to attend classes every morning at the Pasteur Institute in the centre of Lille. Activities have been organised by your hosts for the afternoons. These are not compulsory, but they are intended to add to your knowledge of the country, and we hope most of you will choose to attend them. You can make a note of them now on your timetables. On Monday, there will be a lecture on the history of the town of Lille, followed by a reception at 6 p.m. This will be a good opportunity for you to meet students of your own age at the Institute. On Tuesday, a coach tour of the town has been arranged, starting at 2:30. On Wednesday, there'll be a guided tour of the museum. On Thursday, you can have the afternoon free for shopping or packing, as there's an all-day trip to Paris on Friday before you return on Saturday. You'll get more details of these excursions with exact times and costs when you reach Lille. But this at least gives you some idea of what to expect.
Now you will hear the information again.
As you all know, the town of Morlaix is twinned with Lille in France, and cultural exchanges have been going on between our two towns for some time. However, this is the first year that educational visits have been organized. I'm sure you realize what an important step this is for our respective language programs. And we hope that this joint venture will be a success. I have in front of me details of travel arrangements and a program of the main activities and events which will be taking place during the course of your week in France. I'm sure I don't have to remind you that you have to bring your travel documents, your passports, and your name tags to help your host families meet up with you at the station. In the event of an emergency while you're in France, you should contact the exchange coordinator, Mr. Roland, that's R-O-L-A-N-D. His number is Lille 970-3983. Now, you all have the train and ferry times, both here and in France, printed on your ticket, so I don't need to remind you of these. I'll just go through the main meeting arrangements briefly, so that if there are any questions, we can deal with them now. Everyone should assemble outside the Lost Property Office at Leeds Central Station at least half an hour before the train leaves for London. You're catching the 10 a.m. on Friday, November the 9th. Report to Mr. Owen, who will be accompanying you as far as Paris, and we'll deal with any problems on the journey. He'll also do his best to see that you all make the connection in Paris for Lille. So, stick together as a group. Don't wander off looking for drinks or toilets without letting him know, or you might find you've been left behind. On arrival in Lille, make sure you're wearing your name tags and go to the meeting point under the large clock opposite Platform 2, where your host families will be waiting for you, along with the French exchange coordinator, who will help with the introductions. You'll have the weekend getting to know your host families, and from Monday, you'll be expected to attend classes every morning at the Pasteur Institute in the centre of Lille. Activities have been organised by your hosts for the afternoons. These are not compulsory, but they are intended to add to your knowledge of the country, and we hope most of you will choose to attend them. You can make a note of them now on your timetables. On Monday, there will be a lecture on the history of the town of Lille, followed by a reception at 6 p.m. This will be a good opportunity for you to meet students of your own age at the Institute. On Tuesday, a coach tour of the town has been arranged, starting at 2:30. On Wednesday, there'll be a guided tour of the museum. On Thursday, you can have the afternoon free for shopping or packing, as there's an all-day trip to Paris on Friday before you return on Saturday. You'll get more details of these excursions with exact times and costs when you reach Lille. But this at least gives you some idea of what to expect.
That is the end of part two. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3, Exercise 1, Questions 19 to 23. In this extract, a helicopter pilot, talking in 1988, recalls an important incident. Listen to the extract and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the extract twice.
Well, it didn't seem like anything special at the time. But looking back, it seems to me that maybe it was one of the first examples of real cooperation between the so-called superpowers. At the time, I was a helicopter pilot on board a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier. We were on a routine exercise when we got word of a possible submarine accident in the Atlantic about 1,000 kilometers due east of Bermuda. The Soviets had a submarine out there somewhere, so we assumed that it was one of theirs. All sorts of messages were passing across the world about this stricken sub, and there was, well, I think, a real fear that it might have been carrying nuclear weapons. It was only a few months after the Chernobyl accident, and we were all a bit nervous about some new disaster. We'd received an urgent distress call from the submarine. One of our planes had already flown over the scene and spotted frantic attempts to put out a fire. We heard later that three men had died, and that a number were quite seriously injured. There seemed to have been an explosion in one of the compartments. I'm a pilot, and I cannot imagine anything worse than being involved in an explosion on board a ship or a submarine. Anyway, as we set off to help, it seemed that every single vessel in the area was steaming towards this submarine. There were a number of Soviet ships in the area, and before we arrived on the scene, they had transferred about 50 crewmen to a large cargo ship, apparently full of bananas. The rest of the crew, this submarine had a full crew of around 120, were still busy fighting the fire. As we approached the submarine, which by now was at a very precarious angle, it's amazing it didn't go down in the end, we spotted something in the water about half a kilometer away. We didn't know it then, but this was a crewman from the sub who had been knocked into the water in a second explosion, and who was in a pretty bad way. We circled the area so as to get a good view of the situation, and then lowered down one of our crewmen with a harness for the poor guy in the water. A helicopter crewman goes through hours and hours of training and simulations, and in spite of the difficult conditions we often work in, there are usually very few problems with this sort of operation. To be honest, it looked a lot more spectacular and dangerous than it really is. So, as we were waiting for the signal to get the harness back in, there was a lot of kicking and waving down below, and suddenly our crewman was in the water along with the Soviet he was supposed to be rescuing. Well, to be blunt, we're not really used to rescuing our own crewmen, and now we found ourselves with two people to save and one fewer person to help from the helicopter. I wouldn't care to have to do it again, but one way or other, we were able to lower the spare harness. Actually, having our man in the water with the Soviet was quite useful in getting the poor guy safely strapped in. We had him inside, wrapped up in a couple of blankets in no time. However, Dean, our crewman, had drifted away in the water and was clearly in a bit of trouble. We found out later that he had hurt himself pretty badly when the harness had snapped. I don't know how he managed to give so much assistance in getting the Soviet out of the water. Anyway, we sent down the harness again along with the other crewmen and had them both back and safely inside in a couple of minutes. Both Dean and the Soviet were in pretty poor condition by now, and although they didn't know it then, they were about to spend 6 weeks together in the same military hospital in Bermuda. To cut a long story short, they became the best of friends. And it seems to me, looking back, that this little incident may have played its modest part in easing the tension between the two great superpowers and creating the situation we have now where there seems to be genuine openness and friendship between the people of the East and the West.
Now you will hear the extract again.
Well, it didn't seem like anything special at the time, but looking back, it seems to me that maybe it was one of the first examples of real cooperation between the so-called superpowers. At the time, I was a helicopter pilot on board a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier. We were on a routine exercise when we got word of a possible submarine accident in the Atlantic about 1,000 kilometers due east of Bermuda. The Soviets had a submarine out there somewhere, so we assumed that it was one of theirs. All sorts of messages were passing across the world about this stricken sub, and there was, well, I think, a real fear that it might have been carrying nuclear weapons. It was only a few months after the Chernobyl accident, and we were all a bit nervous about some new disaster. We'd received an urgent distress call from the submarine. One of our planes had already flown over the scene and spotted frantic attempts to put out a fire. We heard later that three men had died, and that a number were quite seriously injured. There seemed to have been an explosion in one of the compartments. I'm a pilot, and I cannot imagine anything worse than being involved in an explosion on board a ship or a submarine. Anyway, as we set off to help, it seemed that every single vessel in the area was steaming towards this submarine. There were a number of Soviet ships in the area, and before we arrived on the scene, they had transferred about 50 crewmen to a large cargo ship, apparently full of bananas. The rest of the crew, this submarine had a full crew of around 120, were still busy fighting the fire. As we approached the submarine, which by now was at a very precarious angle, it's amazing it didn't go down in the end, we spotted something in the water about half a kilometer away. We didn't know it then, but this was a crewman from the sub who had been knocked into the water in a second explosion, and who was in a pretty bad way. We circled the area so as to get a good view of the situation, and then lowered down one of our crewmen with a harness for the poor guy in the water. A helicopter crewman goes through hours and hours of training and simulations, and in spite of the difficult conditions we often work in, there are usually very few problems with this sort of operation. To be honest, it looks a lot more spectacular and dangerous than it really is. Usually very few problems with this sort of operation. To be honest, it looks a lot more spectacular and dangerous than it really is. So, as we were waiting for the signal to get the harness back in, there was a lot of kicking and waving down below, and suddenly our crewman was in the water along with the Soviet he was supposed to be rescuing. Well, to be blunt, we're not really used to rescuing our own crewmen, and now we found ourselves with two people to save, and one fewer person to help from the helicopter. I wouldn't care to have to do it again, but one way or other, we were able to lower the spare harness. Actually, having our man in the water with the Soviet was quite useful in getting the poor guy safely strapped in. We had him inside, wrapped up in a couple of blankets in no time. However, Dean, our crewman, had drifted away in the water and was clearly in a bit of trouble. We found out later that he had hurt himself pretty badly when the harness had snapped. I don't know how he managed to give so much assistance in getting the Soviet out of the water. Anyway, we sent down the harness again along with the other crewmen and had them both back and safely inside in a couple of minutes. Both Dean and the Soviet were in pretty poor condition by now, and although they didn't know it then, they were about to spend 6 weeks together in the same military hospital in Bermuda. To cut a long story short, they became the best of friends. And it seems to me, looking back, that this little incident may have played its modest part in easing the tension between the two great superpowers, and in creating the situation we have now where there seems to be genuine openness and friendship between the people of the East and the West.
That is the end of Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Exercise 2, questions 24 to 27. Listen to this talk about tourism and answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the talk twice.
Good evening, and thank you for coming to listen to me. I'd like to explain what I mean by green tourism. Some of you may think that I'm talking about what is sometimes called ecotourism, so I'd like to clarify my terms. Ecotourism sounds environment-friendly, doesn't it? It's often used to describe tourism in natural areas, mountains, lakes, etc., or holidays that involve watching wildlife. Now, we environmentalists, however, recognize that this kind of tourism may not be as green, by which I mean as harmless to the environment, as it appears to the holidaymaker. You would think that any tour operator promoting ecotourism would have considered the environmental impact of the holidays they offer. But many eco-tourist holidays are in fact far less green than conventional package holidays in seaside resorts. Here's an example of what I mean. Let's look at a Himalayan trekking holiday, which sounds pretty green, and a typical sunshine package tour to the Mediterranean coast, which doesn't sound green at all. If the package tour is well run, it's quite possibly more efficient in transport terms because it fills all the places on the coach or aeroplane. Moreover, it's focused on well-known resorts, so people are not being encouraged to visit as yet unspoilt areas, bringing with them all the ills of mass tourism. The Himalayan trek, on the other hand, may be highly detrimental to the environment because it creates a demand for precious firewood for cooking and heating water, thus adding to the existing problems of deforestation. In addition, the trekkers may leave waste and litter behind them, which might cause pollution or endanger local people or wild animals. So, I hope my remarks will make you think a little more carefully when planning your next holiday. If you'd like more information about holiday companies which are genuinely green and who really conserve and respect the places they visit, I have some leaflets here. Now, perhaps if anyone has any questions.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Good evening, and thank you for coming to listen to me. I'd like to explain what I mean by green tourism. Some of you may think that I'm talking about what is sometimes called ecotourism, so I'd like to clarify my terms. Ecotourism sounds environment-friendly, doesn't it? It's often used to describe tourism in natural areas, mountains, lakes, etc., or holidays that involve watching wildlife. Now, we environmentalists, however, recognize that this kind of tourism may not be as green, by which I mean as harmless to the environment, as it appears to the holidaymaker. You would think that any tour operator promoting ecotourism would have considered the environmental impact of the holidays they offer. But many eco-tourist holidays are in fact far less green than conventional package holidays in seaside resorts. Here's an example of what I mean. Let's look at a Himalayan trekking holiday, which sounds pretty green, and a typical sunshine package tour to the Mediterranean coast, which doesn't sound green at all. If the package tour is well run, It's quite possibly more efficient in transport terms because it fills all the places on the coach or aeroplane. Moreover, it's focused on well-known resorts, so people are not being encouraged to visit as yet unspoiled areas, bringing with them all the ills of mass tourism. The Himalayan trek, on the other hand, may be highly detrimental to the environment because it creates a demand for precious firewood for cooking and heating water, thus adding to the existing problems of deforestation. In addition, the trekkers may leave waste and litter behind them, which might cause pollution or endanger local people or wild animals. So, I hope my remarks will make you think a little more carefully when planning your next holiday. If you'd like more information about holiday companies which are genuinely green and who really conserve and respect the places they visit, I have some leaflets here. Now, perhaps if anyone has any questions.
That is the end of part 3 and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, candidate number, and center number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.